It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your host, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
And good morning, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to see you once again.
Thank you, John.
Good morning, John. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you very much. We're going to be talking about, as I understand it, creditor-debtor relationships and collections and things like that today.
Yes, we are. We've spent the last few weeks talking about some foreclosure laws, some general law relative to the promise to pay. That's where it all begins, when we all enter into these promises to pay. Promises to pay when we buy a car, when we buy a boat, when we buy a piece of land, or when we promise to pay when we buy a good from a Best Buy or a Lowe's or a Home Depot, and we buy it on their credit cards.
Right.
You know, there are contracts that we sign, all mm-hmm. that boilerplate, all that fine print, where basically, John, we're talking about the fact that we agree to promise to pay. Well, promise to pay is a good thing until the day comes when we can't pay.
Right.
And then now we want to talk about, well, how do these creditors collect on these debts, and what are some of the rights and obligations of the creditor, as well as the rights and obligation of the debtor.
Okay, and there are certain protections afforded by law to both parties.
There are, very much so.
That's correct, John. You know, I think Cecil talked last week. I was out of town, so I wasn't here last week, but I think Cecil talked a little bit about the secured creditor and the unsecured creditor, undersecured debt. You know, just the difference being that, you know, if you're secured, that means that there's usually some type of collateral, like the car or the boat, or even the goods, in the event you file what's called a UCC, which is a little bit more complicated, or even a mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the security is what? The property.
Right.
But then when we're talking about consumer debt, credit card debt, those type things, obviously it's a higher interest rate, lower amounts usually, and usually unsecured.
Right.
So, you know, we deal with secured debts and unsecured debts all the time with our clients who are living, and sometimes with the estates that we're dealing with. Obviously, sometimes folks pass away and they've got some secured debt, and some have some unsecured debt. And then in the process of administering estates, you know, we're dealing with the bill collectors, so to speak, or the creditors coming after the estate for the recovery.
Certainly.
So we have to know, obviously, the law as it relates to the debtor-creditor situation for secured debts and unsecured debts to deal with these things appropriately. Because it's not just because, you know, you sign that security agreement that you or your spouse or your loved ones or your family members are absolutely responsible for this debt, okay? And we have to navigate those waters properly so as to not improperly or incorrectly, you know, pay debts that we're not really responsible for paying.
Right.
So when we look at, you know, the collection process, and we look at, you know, a claim being made either against a state, an estate, or someone individually, you know, the first kind of material thing you look at is, let's take a look at the documentation and make sure that that documentation does allow you to do what you're doing as far as collecting.
Certainly.
And just because, you know, let's say your husband had a credit card and the credit card has not been paid, doesn't mean that the wife is automatically responsible for paying for that. So let's talk about that very simple scenario for someone who's living first.
Okay.
Okay. Let's say the husband, you know, had the credit card. Let's say husband and wife are not together anymore. And there is a claim, you know, against the husband, a lawsuit against the husband. And let's say the debt collector shows up at the marital home where the house or where the wife is living, looking for assets. Well, under that scenario, that's pretty simple. The debt was the husband's. The judgment, if the husband is sued, is against who? The husband.
The husband.
So pretty simple. It's not the wife's responsibility. Now, if we're going through a divorce proceeding, then we might have to work that out. Okay, that gets a little bit more complicated.
So that's different, even though the husband is the primary debtor there.
Right.
In a divorce situation, the wife could be involved in that also.
Could be an equitable distribution situation where we're working out the debts and the liabilities and the assets of the husband and wife.
What we're talking about here, John, of course, is the protection of, we need to define marital residence. I mean, that's a special title between husband and wife in the state of North Carolina, known as tenants by entirety. And that's where any deed says John Doe and Mary Doe, and they just happen to be married. It doesn't have to say John Doe and wife or Mary Doe and husband, but if that deed is to two people, and if the time of the deed into the parties, they are in fact married, legal certificate of marriage on record, then by operation of law, that's tenants by entirety property. And this is one of the very significant impacts, import of marriage, the protection of this marital residence from creditors.
Mm-hmm.
And unless the debt is joint between the two, not just the husband's debt, as Wes is defining, then they're not going to be able to go against that marital residence.
Mm. Okay. All right.
Okay.
Well, so, let's take a quick break here and remind folks that they can call in and ask questions having to do with all of these little twists and turns that you find in the debtor-creditor relationship there. You can call 800-818-2255, 247-7282, or 353-4674. You're listening to Harvell and Collins here on the Talk Station, and we'll be right back. Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins are in the studio this morning, and they're here to educate you and inform you and take your questions about creditor-debtor relationships. You can call at 800-818-2255, 247-7282, 353-4674. Learned during the break here that not only can you marry for money, but you can end up marrying for debt too, and that's kind of
Wes has a factual scenario that will fit that profile, and I have one too. So let's go through those two. One that comes up quite often in our office is in the context of folks who have, you know, been married, have children from prior marriages, and now are in their 70s or even 80s, and they're deciding to get married again.
Yeah.
Which is wonderful.
Yes, yeah, good to have a relationship late in life.
Companionship is important, and there they are, you know, with another spouse. They're thrilled to be together. They're enjoying life. And the question evolves, you know, for many of these people want to have a prenuptial agreement, clearly.
Certainly.
So that their assets pass to their separate but respective children.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the problem is that if one of them has more assets than the other, more net worth than the other, if those things are out of kilter, then the more secure financially, more financially secure spouse might be, and here comes the point, John, might be taking on the debt of the nursing home of the less financially secure, to-be spouse. What I'm saying there is that Medicaid will not accept a prenuptial agreement. They look at them, they say thank you very much, but our laws are not going to be applied where we allow your assets to be separate and distinct.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to look at the totality of both the husband and the wife. So the wife's assets, if they're secure, and the husband's assets, if they're less secure, they're all going to get blended together. So that's a very good example of where you marry into potentially the debt of another.
Wow. That's something to be looked for there before you take that big step.
Right. The other scenario we were talking about was actually a particular case that I'm dealing with. Of course, can't use any names, but a situation where the husband had borrowed several $100,000 to buy some real property. There was a marriage. Then after all the documentation had been entered, you know, for the loan, the husband already gotten the loan years before, and then they got married, and And then the husband has some significant health problems and was not able to continue to work. He had been gainfully employed prior to that, spent a lot of his money, and he was fairly well off, trying to keep the debt alive, trying to keep up with the mortgage payments.
Mm-hmm.
Just got to the point where he couldn't do it anymore, and he had to let the property go. Well, of course, the wheels of justice moved forward, and there were judgments that were against him, but just against him. Now, this individual couple, this husband and wife, live in a very nice home, and the wife works, does well,
mm-hmm.
but the house is what? Joint. Is joint, so it's tenants by entirety, just like Cecil was talking about. So there are judgments against this individual husband, and the sheriff has been to the house to look for assets. There are no assets.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the primary asset of the marriage is this home, held tenants by entirety. But it's tenants by entirety, and the debt and the judgment is only in the husband's name. So they cannot collect against this house.
Oh,
so
okay.
That's very, very straightforward situation. Again, we get down to whose debt is it? Is it the husband's? Is it the wife's? Is it both? Now, if it were a joint debt, like Cecil mentioned a moment ago, then the house would certainly be subject to that claim of the creditors.
I see. So yep. there is one of those protections that the law affords to that wife.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And we deal with this all the time in the estate context. I mean, I could think of a case where the deceased had he had $35,000 or $40,000 of tax to pay.
Mm-hmm.
And this was his individual tax liability. And he just didn't have the assets in his estate to cover that. But he had life insurance.
Uh-oh.
He had a couple $100,000 of life insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, before the estate got to us and we were dealing with the estate, the executor, who was the beneficiary of the life insurance, used the life insurance proceeds to pay that $35,000 or $40,000. Well, it didn't really go down that well when we informed her you didn't have to do that.
Oh my goodness.
You could have kept that $35,000 or $40,000 in your pocket. Because this claim by the IRS, North Carolina Department of Revenue, is against the individual who is deceased in the estate, and the life insurance passes outside of those claims. So, again, you have to know how to navigate these waters properly. Otherwise, you can make the $35,000 or $40,000 mistake.
And then when she asked for the $35,000 or $40,000 back, the IRS is right there with a check, right?
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Well, what is hovering around all of this is it began, as I have said several times, with the original promise to pay being a contract. But John, any contract is negotiable. It is amendable. It is modifiable.
Mm-hmm.
All of this is about negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say, for instance, that, that the IRS wants to take a very stern position with regard to the life insurance. Maybe the debt was for $500,000 of mm-hmm. IRS liens and
right.
$1 million policy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there may be some law out there that would allow them to potentially look at that life insurance as a non-probate asset. But they know that they're on very shaky ground relative to that, and so therefore that's an area of negotiation. This happens a lot in Medicaid liens, where folks finally die. They have they've received Medicaid benefits. There is now a lien against the real property because, unfortunately, they left that property in the name of their loved one. Okay.
Uh-huh.
They did not get our legal advice because we wouldn't have done that
right.
if we had been involved. But I had a case last week where that didn't happen, and now mom has died, and there sits that lien against the home place. And what the best that we can do, but yet it's a very good thing for us to do, and the client gets a good result, is to negotiate that
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
debt. The Department of Medical Assistance is going to listen to us. They don't want to particularly have to foreclose on that family property. And guess what? In this particular file, the decedent only owned a portion of the property. So In other words, her interest in the property was already not the whole.
I see.
So particularly now, if I bring that to the attention of the Department of Medical Assistance, I have very strong grounds for a great negotiation and a very good result.
Now, we've demonstrated that there are needs for professional advice such as you fellas offer there, and certainly we would encourage folks to head that way if they find themselves in need or in those positions. You shouldn't be there by yourself trying to decide what's legal and what's not. You could end up paying the IRS $30,000 to $40,000 that you don't need to pay them, and certainly that's not a desirable situation. Cecil Harvell, Wes Collins in the studio this morning, talking about debtor-creditor relationships, and maybe when we come back, we can talk about what the protections are for the debtor. All right, we've been talking about the benefits of law to the person who owes the money. Now let's talk a little bit about what some of the benefits in law are to those who have loaned the money.
Right. Well, I mean, we're in a situation, you know, where the rubber hits the road, John, where, you know, a lot of times our clients come in and their first concern when they have a debt that's owed, that's in default, is why will the phone not stop ringing?
Right. Mm-hmm.
What can we do to get the debt collector to stop calling us?
Right.
Do I have to talk to them?
Mm-hmm.
Do I have to tell them things? What do I what do I do with regard to that? Well, we do have a statute in North Carolina called the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that that statute indicates is that in the event that the debtor is represented by counsel, represented by an attorney, or the debt collector then by law cannot continue to try to contact the debtor.
Right.
So, you know, a lot of times we're dealing with consumer debt or either secured debt, and one of the most preliminary and best things we do for our clients is get the phone to stop ringing.
Right.
By simply sending the letter indicating, you know, we represent John Doe, and please direct all further communications to this law firm with regard to this matter. And then, you know, obviously we start the discourse and communications regarding negotiation or whatever our position is. We're asking for documents, those kind of things. But all during the period of time that that's happening, the debt collector cannot then continue to contact the debtor.
Right.
Which is, I hear, wonderful for them. That's what they tell me.
Yeah,
anyway.
I would think.
So the law protects them in that regard.
Yeah.
And in the event that a debt collector does not adhere to that, then there's some very significant penalties in our statutes with regard to that.
Right. And just to clarify, just because the phone doesn't stop, just because you're able to stop the phone from ringing, the debt still exists and the collector can still proceed with certain actions to collect the debt.
Just have to do it through the lawyer.
Got to do it through the lawyer, though.
That's right.
That's
okay.
Right.
So, some of the other issues, you know, that we deal with and we've talked about before, and we've really talked about today just the, consumer debt more than secured debt. But all of these things also deal with the deficiency actions as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that would really be more of a consumer debt type situation, a judgment type situation after a foreclosure. We talked about this 2 or 3 weeks ago, and we've talked about it previously on the program. You know, after a foreclosure, if there's and the property's been sold, it's been repurchased, and maybe the bank has resold it, or maybe a third party came in and bought the property, but there's still, let's say, $50,000 or $100,000 due on the debt. Well, the bank or the lender does have the right within 1 year of the sale. There's a short statute of limitations, 1 year. To then file a separate lawsuit for collection of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that follows the same set of rules that we've dealt with regard to all these other debts, the credit card debt, the Best Buy debt, the Walmart debt, whatever it ends up being on credit cards, consumer type debt. We look at whose name is that debt under. Is it husband and wife, or is it just husband,
right,
or is it just wife? That type situation, because all that is would be a lawsuit against the borrower for collection of that deficiency. And, you know, in the event that comes to pass, then we're right back at the point where there's a judgment. And once there's a judgment, that judgment is in the defendant's name, who is husband, wife, or both, or, you know, just depends on the circumstance.
Right.
And then the debt collection starts on that.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the phone starts ringing, or you might get a document called a notice of right to claim exemptions.
Right.
Which is very important statutory document that gives you only 20 days to exempt certain property under the statutes from collection,
mm-hmm.
which can protect things like a car with certain limitations, personal property with certain limitations, property used in a business with certain limitations, those type things. But in the event that you fail to fill out that document when it's served on you within 20 days, you waive your right, and then any assets that you have are subject to collection.
The house or the car or the tools or whatever.
That's right, but certainly also subject to these other rules we talked about. Again, mm-hmm. if it's a husband's debt and they're you know, husband and wife, and they own their property as tenants by entirety, can't get to that. Or if it's the wife's debt, you can't get to the joint property. But you can certainly get to any property that would only be held in the husband's name if it were his judgment.
Well, it's certainly an interesting area of discussion there, the relationship between creditors and debtors, and how that relationship plays out in a situation where the promises that the debtor has made cannot be fulfilled. Cecil Harvell, Wes Collins, Let's Talk Legal is part of Coastal Daybreak every Tuesday, beginning at 7:30 in the morning. It's been a pleasure, gentlemen, to see you again.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
Take care. We'll be back with more Coastal Daybreak in just a moment.